the quality estimation framework, which were the discourse level. So they were both on feature engineering. So one was trying to come up with discourse level features, and the other was trying to model human translation as opposed to machine translation, so predict the quality of human translations. We had a big group, so not everyone was there all the time, but we basically worked together in both projects. A lot of the work in the first day or two was just to get people to know the code and to understand it, so we spent quite some time with that, and helping people to add new features, so just showing them how you could do that in general. We had a lot of brainstorming about what we wanted to add for both projects. We had a list of error categories for human and machine translation that we used as a basis. And we also had some predefined ideas for the discourse level features. We've seen this before. These were the error categories. We looked at also different corpora that we could use for the project. This was one that we've thought of using for the human translation quality estimation, but it's actually machine-translated data here, but it has annotations at the word level, so we looked at it more as a source of inspiration to for the types of errors we could look at. This was a new thing for me, at least, that Mark found, this Melange corpus, which is a corpus of human translations done by translation students. With errors annotated at the word level. It's quite, there's lots of language pairs there and different types of errors, somehow strange error categories, but it's, we're still looking at it. It looks useful overall. So the issue here was that we needed a corpus with, labels for translation quality with translations produced by humans, that had not only good quality translations, which is easy to find, but also bad quality translations. So, and that's not very hard to, well, not very easy to find, because basically we don't know about bad quality translations. So we took a corpus by Chris Callison-Birch and Omar Zedin, which had been translated by Turkers. So you probably know the corpus already. It's Urdu into English. So there's a bunch of almost 2,000 source sentences. They were translated, each of them was translated by four Turkers. They also had four human professional translation references. And then each of the Turk translations was post-edited by other Turkers, and one to three times. So it's a large resource, and it doesn't have labels for the quality of the translations, but we can sort of try and guess them by comparing the Turk translations to the references. So this is what we did. We annotated this sentence with Meteor scores by looking at these four references. And this was just a very, very preliminary set of experiments. So we had a model for each of these translators and editors, the Turkers. And we're just using the baseline features here more as a way of showing that we probably don't, we can't do enough with the features we have now for human translation quality estimation. So we're trying to predict Meteor scores here. And this is root mean squared error, comparing the true Meteor scores against the predicted Meteor scores. In the middle column there, what we have is a very simple baseline, which we basically just use the mean scores of the training set on a test set. So it's normally a strong baseline to beat for this task. No quality estimation there, just using the mean of the training set. And then the last column, we're actually using the baseline features, so without any additional features for human translation. And yeah, we get slightly better results, but not a lot. So not sure it's significant. I haven't measured that. But just to show that what we have there probably doesn't work at least not for this data set. And this is the same, just different editors. So these were Meteor scores predicted in post-editing as opposed to translations. But we get very little gains from using Quest as opposed to not doing anything, basically. So this is why we wanted to add this additional information for human translations. We didn't get very far with the in terms of features that were actually added to the code. These are the ones we have now. Some of them are very simple, like we had a list of slang words in English, so we could just check if they were in the target language. Abbreviations, check for inconsistencies in abbreviations. So these all come from this these categories that we had for human and machine translation errors, but mostly human errors. We added named entity recognizer for English, so just a Stanford tool there. So we count named entities. We did some work on terminology, so both monolingual terminology, so just checking whether the words in the source and or target belong to given lists of terminology, and also whether we have, say, a given terminology in the source sentence, so we should also expect to have the corresponding term in a target language, the target sentence, so we're counting whether that's not the case. So, and we're not using alignment here, these are all system-independent features. And then José has been working on again, it's related to terminology, but more to trying to learn the terminology from a corpus and then check whether the sentences have the correct terminology for a given domain. So in the previous case, we actually give the data set of the terminology, and in the other one, we try to learn it from corpora using cross-lingual entropy techniques. This was for human translation quality estimation, and then for the other project, and I don't, we don't have experiments yet with this. People just finished integrating them, or most of them, yesterday, but we'll have them shortly. And for the other project on the discourse level quality estimation or translation quality estimation, these are mostly features. These were added already, and these are features to do that are to do with lexical cohesion. So basically, looking at repetition of words and lemmas and ratios of this in its source and target. Very, very simple ones, but basically they count this at a document level, and then for every sentence you get a proportion of things that are repeated across the document or a number. And this we are able to test in the corpus of subtitles, English-Portuguese, where we consider an episode as a document. So we count things within each episode. And in this case, we had 6 episodes and for 3 different series, TV series, and we're predicting HTR scores here. We had post-editings for these sentences when we just predict HTR scores. And we had that for multiple empty systems. We're just doing it for one here. We'll do it for the others later. But this is a different story. So the first column here is the same baseline, so just predicting the mean of the training set without doing any quality estimation. And then the baseline features we had before in the middle column, and this baseline plus the additional features, so we actually see some gain there, and it's significantly better than the mean of the training set only. So I think this is promising, although these are very simple features, but we keep looking into those. So just trying to put together, in addition to the features, what we were able to do this week was to select or prepare some data. So we had this corpus from this Turk translations, which we just prepared in a way that we can use for quality estimation. And then Christian Buck is working a bit on this Melange corpus just to get the annotations. It's lots of XML files with standoff annotations. So we're just trying to get it in a format that is useful for both word level and sentence level quality estimation. And then we have, again, the corpus of subtitles that we have worked with, and it's all ready to use. And we have a number of resources that people found on the web for, I don't know, slang words, abbreviations, using Erevoc for terminology as well. We have style guides from the European Commission for different languages, so they specify what the date formats for dates and times and so on are for in different languages. So very simple things, but which can be very useful as well. And we're able to integrate some of the code already, and the rest is being done, or will be done shortly. And that's it.
Okay, the first project is language model interpolation, and there's a bit of a surprise going on with this. So linear interpolation specifically is what we're talking about. Log linear is somewhat trivial because you can just run with multiple language models in your Moses.ini, and that gives you log linear interpolation. But here we want to have linear interpolation, which is considered to be more pure in some sense, that it's mixing the probabilities instead of the log probabilities. In general, you have multiple language models. In this talk, I'm just going to mention the simpler case of two language models mixed with some weight lambda. So one way to implement this is you can just load models into RAM and put them next to each other in RAM, and you query both of them at runtime and mix their probabilities with some little bit of code. And this is what AirStillM will do for you. So the fundamental question, the goal of this project in some sense, is to use less RAM and also less CPU time, because you wouldn't have to look up in all these individual models and retrieve the interpolated probability that way. So SRILM claims to do this. You can take an interpolated language model and meet this criterion. So for all words and all histories, it claims to give you this interpolated language model. It also produces an ARPA file, and you query this ARPA file in the normal way. This is what the interpolate program will do when you write LM. This is what most people think interpolation is supposed to do when they use SRILM. And it stores the union of the n-grams from the two language models. So if you run the SRI interpolate program and you take the set of n-grams in the original models that you're interpolating, you'll find that it contains the union of them in the larger one. I'm adding this condition here because theoretically you could just store all possible 5 grams in a giant ARPA file, and that's one way to solve the problem I'm about to bring up. But this is actually impossible to do, I claim. I claim that you cannot meet all three of those conditions at once. And the fun part of this is the project was supposed to do this, and we've come up with the proof that you can't. So SRILM actually implements not equals to the what you think it does. And the fun thing is people tune the interpolation weights thinking that it does interpolate the language models. And that's what compute best mix does in SRI. And then after you've optimized those lambdas, it actually implements something different than what you optimized for. I'm going to go into a bit more detail about what I mean by that and a sketch of proof that you can't actually do this. So if the n-gram is 1, let's suppose, appeared in any of the language models that you're interpolating, then SRI does what you would expect. It actually produces an explicit probability in the language model that encodes the mixture of the two weights, and everything is fine, and you can query it, and you'll get that probability. That also means that all the probabilities in the language model have to follow this formula explicitly. The model has to sum to 1. That's actually a corollary of the condition that they're interpolated. You can prove that an interpolated language model still sums to 1, and because of this property, and what I mean by summing to 1 is the probability of any word given a history, if you sum up all the possible words that you could predict, that sums to 1 still. And that means that the backoffs in the language model are also fixed. You can prove, and SRI has done this, that there's a formula to determine the backoff weights that are stored in an ARPA language model just from the probabilities. And let's say we query something that's not in any of the language models that you're trying to interpolate. So we would expect to run this interpolated language model with the normal backoff algorithm. That was one of the conditions from the previous slide. And you can expand it as the probability of periwinkle times the backoff of is. That's just the normal bog standard backoff algorithm from Marcello's lecture earlier. And that's not going to come up with the probability that you get by backing off in each of the individual language models. And actually, if you solve for the backoff of is in this equation, supposing that it were to be equal, you'll find that it depends on periwinkle, and therefore the backoff is not a function. In some sense, this is just a proof by counterexample, that once you say that the probabilities and the backoffs have to be fixed subject to these conditions, you just find an example where it doesn't work at producing the probabilities that you want for an n-gram that's not in any of the models. So, rough proof, but I haven't gone into complete detail of showing you that this is impossible, but that's the general idea. And then people ask, what's the empirical impact on perplexity? So those two guys up there ran in a little experiment. You take Uroparl and a UN corpus, and you split off 1,000 tuning sentences for tuning the interpolation weights and 1,000 evaluation sentences. And in this case, the results I'm reporting are based on you take these two models, and then you tune the weights on Uroparl, and then you evaluate on Uroparl. And lower perplexity is better. So SRI is a fake interpolation, which is what most people use, has this perplexity of 41.93, and there's a dynamic interpolation option past dash Bayes zero to SRI, and you get a slightly higher perplexity. I'm a little worried that there might be a bug there. And then the last line, you get a lower perplexity by just manually interpolating what you think it should be according to the equation I started with at the beginning. So this does actually impact perplexity. Lane Schwartz is supposed to be doing a blue experiment, but I imagine Mert takes a while since we only started doing this yesterday. So what now? Can we find a non-ARPA but efficient way to encode interpolated language models? I don't know yet. Can we implement the broken version anyway and just advertise that it's broken because people seem to like using it? And the larger goal is to convince Philip Kuhn that we can kill SRI support in Moses, and that was part of the motivation for this interpolation project anyway. And that's an open research question as well. Yeah, there's actually no code anymore except for the thing to query stuff. Well, okay, so if the way SRI is implemented is it reconstitutes backoff weights from probabilities using the property that thinks something to one. So if you don't think through the part of, gee, maybe these backoff weights aren't a function, and it just gives you this nice thing. So what actually probably ended up happening is someone wrote the code that generates the backoff weights. Someone else wrote the code that generates the probabilities much later. And those are two separate parts of SRI. Like the backoff weight generation is used for building the Kinaser 9 model to begin with. And maybe they're aware of this, maybe they're not. We've been doing some archaeology on SRILM user and the original JHU workshop paper, and so far as we can tell, there's no documentation of how to compute the backoff weights in an interpolated language model as if they hadn't thought about the problem. It tells you how to compute the probabilities, and then just doesn't mention the backoffs. Okay, so that was fun. Now that I've destroyed your faith in several WMT papers worth of results, we can go on to pruning language models. And Marcin, mind if I check that?
Okay, now that's the second part of the project. Since Kenneth wants to get rid of SRI, the other thing that we need to do is implement pruning. Well, here we started another way around. We started implementing first and thinking later. The results are kind of similar to the first part of the... So either way, it doesn't seem to be a good way there. Well, what did we do? So to prune, we just figured that we will just use the normal engram counts and prune away engrams that have too low counts. Sounds like it. We are not using adjusted counts for the moment. We are using the real counts. And we just delete engrams with counts lower or equal to a specified threshold. For instance, let's say we delete all, we have a 5 gram model, we delete all 5 grams that appear only once and leave the rest inside. There's a couple of subtle problems there because of, first thing would be, because of the smoothing method used. Modified KNESS-NA requires, if we compute adjusted counts, that we have access to all the engrams, to compute discounts and so on. And another problem is kind of stream architecture. In order to make that work, we have to push a lot of information to the streams. We cannot just delete the counts and hope that everything will work out. We need to push, information which backoffs still survive and so on through those streams. So this is, kind of a conceptual problem on one hand and an implementation problem on the other hand. And now I'm far too far away from the button. Okay, so this is another time graphical display of Kenneth's implementation of alarm please of the estimation procedure. What we had to modify are the red fields. So we had to, at one point, we had to, in the adjusting part, we removed all the engrams from the vertical stream. So, if we look at the main stream, at the main direction, the engrams are not going through to the bottom, but are being removed. That would be the pruning part. But we have, to keep them in order to compute adjusted counts and discounts. And next thing we had to do was, modify the backoff calculation for that. The problem is, if we remove, engrams, at least higher order engrams, let's say five grams for, five gram model. Then when we calculate backoffs for 4 grams, we don't know anymore, whether these 4 grams are a context of an engram that we've seen because we've pruned an engram. So, and later when we want to interpolate these orders, we cannot really, that is one thing. And another thing, so that means that we are not, that we are not calculating the backoffs anymore. So the streams start to desynchronize. At one moment, we have more engrams in the main stream than we have backoffs in the other stream. We have to recombine the stream again. The numbers don't match. So at some moment, we just don't know anymore, which backoff to assign to which engram and so on. We had to solve this by adding dynamically hashing values to the stream so we can find the backoffs again and so on and so on. There was a technical problem. For instance, we don't want to add hash values to streams if we are not actually doing pruning because then we would destroy the efficiency of the stream model. So at some point we had to modify the code to add hash values only when we are pruning in one stream, not add hash values to other streams. There are always several streams around, so this was quite complicated, but we managed to do that yesterday around 6 o'clock in the evening. So we had a good time, so we could already do some first results concerning size and speed. These are results for a 5-gram language model built from the English part of the French-English Europal. We took the first, I think there are 2 million sentences and something, yeah. We took the first 2 million sentences as training data and the remaining 7,000 sentences as test data. Well, but there's no test yet, so just that this will come later. So pruning definitely helps when it comes to size, which is actually what we wanted to achieve. Also, estimation is much faster because we get rid of the engrams already before the whole estimation process is starting, so we can reduce size and time. So it would seem success. But as we already seen, there's something missing. What about perplexity? And this is where things start to go horribly wrong, unfortunately. So in the after we were very happy yesterday at 6 o'clock in the evening, we started, yeah, let's try what perplexity is looking like in SRI. Let's do a sanity test. And this is our great defeat here. So as long as we don't prune, we have exactly the same numbers. But when we start pruning, it's becoming really, really bad. Pruning of 5 grams with a frequency of 1 and below reads already a difference in 1.2 perplexity. And when we go lower, so prune of 4 grams and 5 grams, later 3 grams, 4 grams and 5 grams, 2 grams, 3 grams, 4 grams and 5 grams, it becomes really horrible. So while SRI is keeping a more or less constant perplexity, our perplexity is going through the roof, which is not something, unfortunately, these are not blue points. I would be happy if this were blue points. It's perplexity. So, yeah, I think I said that. So it's 2 grams and above. So everything, whenever we prune something, so when we set, for instance, that we want to prune 2 grams at a frequency of 1, this also means that we will also prune off everything above at a frequency of 1. So the question is, what's going wrong there? That was the first conclusion. It's an ugly bug. Can you see that? Yeah, it's actually really ugly here, so this worked out. Then we started checking. It turns out it's not a bug. Unfortunately, it's also not a feature, so you can't use that explanation. It follows, unfortunately, from the math. So it's a math problem, which is as ugly as the bug. And the problem we have there is that the way we used to calculate, that CanLM uses to calculate backoffs, is just not prepared for pruning. It works very well if you don't prune. But there's something seriously going wrong with backoff weights when we prune. So instead of going up, they go down. And by quite significant margins. We compared that to SRI. SRI is able to keep about the same backoff weights even when they prune. There are small differences, while our backoff weights go down by a factor of 2 or more. So something is wrong there. We haven't yet figured out what's wrong. Kenneth thinks that he has to derive some new formula for that. Might be possible. I suggested normalizing, for which I was nearly strangled, so that's probably not a good solution. Okay, so this means there's still some work left. I'm confident that it's the smaller part of work. At least that's what I hope. And the worst case, we'll just see what SRI is doing and try to copy their idea. And implementation-wise, I think we are nearly done. We just have to figure out the ugly bits now. That would be it. Questions? Yes. A little bit louder, please. We wanted to have something that we can do really quickly. Yeah, we saw that. So. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, right. This project was about implementing multi-path decoding in Moses and using CSLM, which is the continuous space language model from Holger Schwenk and the team at Le Mans. So it was quite an ambitious project, so there's probably a bit too ambitious for 1 week. And these are the people responsible. So first of all, there's two sub-goals. One is to integrate CSLM into MOSES, and the other sub-goal is to implement multi-pass decoding. So the CSLM is just like any other language model. It takes a phrase and it gives you a score. It works slightly differently from normal Arthur-style language models, but essentially that's what it does. We had some problems with this. First of all, it's never been used outside of the people who built it. So it's only been used in that LIMSY and that Le Mans. So when we tried to compile it on our own machines, there were some problems, including it's dependent on an Intel library, which isn't free, so we had to download it. And not only is it not free, it requires the latest Mac OS. So I had a fun night installing the latest Mac OS. And the LIMSY guys, the Le Mans guys, also asked us to on the second pass to actually change all the weights. So rather than just expand, keep the same weights, we have to change the weights in the decoder as well. So that's the issues with CSLM. So multipass decoding, in principle is quite easy. So once you've done your first pass, your first decoding pass, all you want to do is actually look in each stack, look at each hypothesis and score it with the new feature function with CSLM. So that was what we thought we had to do. But there are some issues. So the first issue is asynchronous calculation. So one of the main reasons to do multipass decoding is that your feature function may be very slow, or it has a lot of latency. So you want to actually be able to just give it the hypothesis and let it go away and do its thing, and then just wait for it to come back in a few seconds. So we kind of like managed to do a framework for that. But the main problem is state splitting. So what is state splitting? So imagine that this is your the result. If this is your input is Le Sha, and the result of your decoding is an output graph like this. So if you have no language models, so your search graph would be the nodes are a lot of your hypotheses would be recombined. So if you have no language models, then they all be recombined like this. But when you try to rescore it with a stateful function, you can't guarantee that the recombination is actually the same. So when you rescore with a stateful function, something like this may happen. So that you one node becomes two, and then you have to change the lattice so that when it splits like that, you have to actually change it like this. And which makes it an extremely difficult. It's not just a rescoring; it's actually a recreation of your lattice. So we didn't really think about that when we first started, and we're trying to get on with it now. So Jacob is looking at how to actually create a search graph and how to actually allow the search graph to be expanded when the state split. I've been looking into MOSES to actually implement the multipass decoding, which is fairly easy, to actually enable feature functions to be evaluated asynchronously. So I'm going to hand over to Jacob, who's going to tell you more detail of what he did.
So I explained how search graph works. Right now, Moses has several implementations of search graphs already. Some of them are used for just printing them on the output stream. However, some of them are more tricky. For example, Lattice MBR decoding that uses some kind of search graph and calculates like forward backward probabilities on it. So what we want to do, we want to make some unified search graph structure that could be used for any purpose. So what are the requirements for that kind of structure? So first of all, we think that it's reasonable to say that each edge in a search graph matches a hypothesis. And each vertex matches a winning hypothesis in a list of combined hypotheses. So when hypotheses are combined, it actually means that two edges go to the single vertex. Then we want to make it independent of all the structures that Moses creates and then deletes after decoding. And specifically, that means that we don't bind to any structure like hypothesis. That's maybe like not too obvious for people who are not developers of Moses, but still. All the existing search graph structures, they do not copy anything. They just do link. Put the links to the hypothesis in the search text directly. And the main operation that graph supports is iterating through edges, let it say like all edges or outcoming edges for single vertex or incoming edges for single vertex. That seems to be enough for everything. Now, how we construct the search graph? We can first thing we implemented, that's the one thing out of those three that is actually implemented right now. So we can use the decoder stacks to construct the search graph. That's somewhat duplication of available features because all search graph implementations have to do that. What it does, it ensures that the vertices in the search graph are ordered topologically because that helps for some algorithms, and that's ensured by proper ordering when we build the search graph. So we use depth first search. Then second thing is that if we want to rescore a graph, we add new features to it. So what we have to do, we need to calculate the new features for each edge of the graph and rescore those edges, and that's been implemented right now, but not yet complete. And third thing is that's most tricky one, is that if we add stateful features, then technically vertices can be split, and that makes things not quite easy. So what we suggest, we haven't started implementing it yet, but what we suggest is that we make a new kind of decoding search algorithm which has that graph as an input. So that's mostly like Lattice decoding, but we do not allow any kind of reordering, and we use existing translation options with some additional information. So for that purpose, we say that every edge results in a translation option, and then we just get to implement our own decoder for that.
Yeah. So that's the end of our talk. We'll probably continue with it. It's a feature that's quite useful, I think. So, but it's quite complicated to implement. So yeah. Thanks.
Oh, it's for the recording, right? Okay. Okay, so here are the names of the people in the group. So we had, as before, we had four teams, a pretty large project, perhaps the largest, I guess. So just to remind you what we're doing, we're trying to predict words, and we're targeting English to Czech. So the idea is to predict a Czech word given its links to the English source sentence and, of course, the context as well. There was, however, a stealth project inside the project, which was that we implemented minimal translation unit extraction in a standard phrase-based framework. So the idea here is that minimal translation units are a subset of the phrases that are normally extracted. We trained the standard phrase sense disambiguation pipeline on minimal units, and then Philip summarized the results as, it is a possibly promising result showing issues that are conducive to further consideration. The baseline is kind of interesting. So this is on the French to English data set from DMT. This is 139,000 sentences. And the tune fit on phrases is 29.7. And the tune fit on minimal translation units is 28.9. So pretty close, 0.8 drop for using minimal translation units. But this seems promising, and it should be interesting to compare discriminatively predicting phrases with discriminatively predicting minimal translation units. Okay, so going back to what we were supposed to be doing, which is the discriminative word lexicon, so that's predicting words given their target words given their aligned source words. We followed a bunch of steps, so we built an English to Czech baseline, and then we figured out the lexicon lookup, so that's the idea is, again, that a Czech word is predicted based on its aligned English words. We ignore the other links to those English words, right? So each Czech word is aligned to zero or more words, and it doesn't matter what else is aligned to the English words. And the first thing we did was to build a kind of phrase lexicon for this representation. We also converted the 15-position MSD Czech tags to a human-readable form. And, of course, we had to retarget our classifier feature extraction from phrases to words. So the pipeline now looks like you create a extract file. So that's for each word, what is it aligned to? Then we create something that looks like a phrase table, but it's translating from these source groups to a single word. And we run feature extraction, I'll talk about that a little more in a second, train the classifier, and evaluate accuracy. And, of course, there's also a pipeline that involves decoding because this is mostly integrated into the decoder. So here are the features that are used, and these are all implemented. So on the source, it's word, lemma, POS tag, and number, and also things like parent and grandparent nodes, left child, rightmost child, left sister and right sister in a dependency parse of the source sentence. On the target side, we have word, lemma, and the 15 features corresponding to part of speech, number, gender, case, etc. Okay, so in terms of detailed changes, we modified the previous phrase-based pipeline to work on these aligned groups. We created this sept table, except that it should be source group table to replace the phrase table. And then we did the feature extraction, and that required modification as well because we did not have null phrases in the previous setup, and now we have alignments to null, so target words that spontaneously appear. Okay, and Christina will present the results.
Yes, so these are just results on classification for reference sentences. We got some results that are a little bit puzzling. So the comparison here is prediction using just the source group of words, like relative frequency of predicting the most frequent target for each source group, And the second model uses just local context, the word to the left and right. So this is not evaluating the full model with all the morphosyntactic features because it didn't finish training, but just comparing something that doesn't use context to something that uses a little bit of context. So we can see that the training accuracy, so this is the baseline doesn't use context. While using local context, the training accuracy improves quite a bit. So it overfits, but on the test set, it just budges just slightly. So we've never seen such a thing before, so we have to investigate. So the next steps for the project, we need to figure out the puzzling results. Another step is to rename the model and all the files associated with it to something distinguishable from several other things called discriminative lexicon in the code. An exciting comparison that we are planning to do is to compare word level, MTU level, and phrase level prediction. There are some steps that need to be done to be able to do that. The classification already works for all of those, and the decoder integration works for the last two and is very close for the word level. And next step, which should be very useful, is to add target context to the model to be able to capture agreement. But that will require quite a bit of figuring out how to make it efficient.
And I wonder, do we still have anyone to present? So we have, something is coming. So anyone? So that would be the spelling.
Okay, so this empty spell project was to do a spelling correction for post-edited machine translation output, where we know what is being translated, but the clumsy post editor put in some new spelling errors. And what we were looking specifically for would be the opportunity to correct some of the real world errors, where we have a word that actually appears in the dictionary, but it is wrong in the context because it differs a bit. The advantage that we have over, say, standard word processors is that we are willing to throw much more resources at this, and we would have an in-domain language model. We know what has been translated. We know the search graph. So we can use all these resources and all this information to make better suggestions. This was the motivation from the very first slide on Monday. This is a current LibreOffice, and it doesn't get any of all these spelling errors in here, because it doesn't mark real word errors, because many of the spell checkers that we have today are still based on single words. They look them up in the dictionary. If they're okay, everything is fine, but that's not what we want. So we started building a pipeline, and the picture pretty much shows the state of the pipeline. We have many pieces that we still need to fit together a bit, but they are in place. Everything perfectly arranged. So the thing we do is we have the sentence that the post editor produced, and for each word we come up with a number of candidates. And we hypothesize splitting the word or joining it with the previous one, stuff like this. And then we locally score these. So we look at, say, we have a word and we edit it a bit and then we say, okay, this sounds the same, so that the sound score is low, but many words change, many letters change, so the edit distance is high, and many scores like this. We produce a search graph, much like we have in machine translation, and then we stick the search graph into Ken's decoder and score it with a language model and all the feature weights, and then we hope for the best. Right. What are some of the features that we developed over the week? Usually we would take candidates from just looking in the dictionary. Hey, there's many words with a low edit distance to this word, so this may be candidates. But that's not a good idea, because not all candidates are equally likely, and not all misspellings are equally likely. We look at the actual sequence of edit operations and see what has changed, and we try to learn a very good distance measure from actual common misspellings that we see in a misspelling corpus. For example, if you're in the internet and you often live in spaces that are legally dubious, you might be used to confuse S and Z. Please let us know. We want to give a lower penalty to confusing this two, others may have a higher penalty. So, and the other thing that might be a good idea to introduce in a distance metric would be to penalize the position where the error is made, because it really looks obvious if you confuse the first error in the word, but in the middle of the word, there might be additional letters that you want to remove. So we have an annotated corpus of like 40,000 misspellings, and we did all these alignments and built a nice matrix for which letters can be confused with each other, and use this to weight the actual edits. And we can look at this and see that if I confuse from and firm, this actually gets a very different score from if I use from and from, and that's because the I is very close on the keyboard to the O. So these can easily be confused, and we can the L is very similar because the L is also in the area of the O on the English keyboard, but the A is far away, so the score is much higher. And then we looked at the positions, and we basically did the same thing. We looked, okay, where do these edits happen? But for this, we have a nice visualization. So we looked at the edits and made a bit of a density function using kernel smoothing. And I just show the picture right away. So we can see most of the edits, if we just look at substitutions, most of these substitutions happen rather at the beginning or at the end of the word, and there's a bit of a dent in the first third, so we can use this to come up with another distance metric. Insertions, as you would imagine, that you can change a plural or singular forms. Insertions rather happen at the end of a word, and so do deletions, probably due to the same causes that we have morphology changes, which in English I guess is plural. Yeah, and here again, there's an example. If we change stuff at the beginning or at the end, or if we substitute stuff at the beginning or at the end, that was the first one here, that is, gets a lower score than if we do these substitutions in the middle. Okay, then we have homophone algorithms, where we have a lower penalty on candidates that sound the same, which makes sense because that's what people confuse. And we use a Soundex algorithm in a Python implementation. It's actually a funny thing, because the Python implementation actually changes the static string from the Python interpreter. It snatches the underlying byte structure and changes it, which was terrible to debug. And we have this example from the old Moses t-shirt from the last marathon here. The check and check have the same sound X representation, and they get a lower penalty then. Okay, so we find candidates by looking at the word and then finding many candidates from the dictionary, and we need a really fast way to do this. And the naive way would be to just compare with every single entry in the dictionary. And Peter Norvig does an even more excessive way, but it's very nicely written, so it's still good. He produces all the possible distortions of the input and compares these with the dictionary, which is a similar way to do it. And you should definitely check out his spell checking tutorial, which is very nice. But we found online a much faster algorithm that is easily able to generate candidate sets. You take the word and you delete any two letters or any three letters from it, and you come up with a set of shorter words that are missing one up to n letters. But you need to keep the whole one, and then you have a large set of possible shortenings of that word. And when you you do this for all the words in your dictionary, and you remember, you have an inverse index of this fragment and pointing back to the word it originally came from. And now when you have a new word, you produce the same set, and you use the reverse index to very quickly come up with a list of possible candidates that could have an edit distance in this expected range, and then you only need to compute the edit distance for this very limited set. This is much, much faster, especially if we have a rather high edit distance, and edit distance is expensive to compute. So we have a very nice C++ implementation of this now. It's not yet integrated. It will be integrated later today or tomorrow or somewhere. But use minimal. Willy, can you comment on this, what the minimal perfect hashes do? Okay. Okay, and we know them. We know them because we have the dictionary. Okay, so we have a crazy fast implementation of coming up with the candidates, and then we only need to compute the feature functions, which are very cheap, and then the scoring is cheap as well. So we can have a really performant implementation of this. To lower the performance a bit, we allow splits of words, which actually is quite common in spelling errors that we've seen. And we just hypothesize basically all the splits, and then we look for the parts we split, and can these be made into a dictionary word by using one less edit than when we had used before, right? So if we have this example, we hypothesize, for example, my dog, and we would try to make the second one into a word, which can be either day or dog, and then we put all these in the letters, and the letters explode, which is really nice because we have a very large search space and might find interesting corrections. So we are almost done. What is the progress? We can produce these candidates. We have a couple of scoring functions that are nicely implemented, and we have this fast candidate generation that we can use to get this all in a performant way. Splitting and joining and writing a more complex graph is soon to be implemented. We're almost done, and we have basically done no evaluation or training of the feature weights that we use. We just fiddle around with them on the command line. But we can show some examples. So here, example is kissed a girl one night and her eyes were burning blue, which is from some actual spelling correction corpus. And we stick this in our spell checker, the spell.py, and give it some parameters, and it will write this graph, and then we stick it into Ken's decoder, and it actually produces kissed a girl one night and her eyes were burning blue. If we fiddle with the weights a bit little, it will also propose kill the girl one night. And worse things. Sorry? No, it's a language model. The language model's to blame. And this is already only done with a 2-gram language model, so we're very happy to see these results. One thing I want to point out that here, that the here in that gets corrected to her is a word in the dictionary, and we found a real word error using the language model, and here is not even an obscure word that we corrected to something more common. It is a very common word, and it makes sense in many contexts, but we still catch this error. So that's good. And we catch the error even though the next word also has to be corrected. So that actually shows the potential of this lattice approach here. This is the last example and the last slide. They had cleaned the river and made it very wide for the ducks. So we have three errors in here, and the correction can either be they had cleaned or they have cleaned. Both are actually proposed in the search graph, and the language model decides it's they have cleaned. If you fiddle with the weights, everything breaks terribly. But it works a bit already, and we are looking forward to include all the improvements that we have planned and have some automatic way to tune the weights here to correct all the errors in some corpus. Thanks.